This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. The New York Review of Books is considered one of the foremost intellectual publications in the U.S. It's been home to challenging statements and provocative ideas for decades. The man I'm speaking with this morning is author and former New York Review of Books editor-in-chief, Ian Buruma. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first off the bat, Ian, I don't want to oversimplify the story, but I want to get our listeners on the same page so that perhaps we can get quickly into this part of the conversation. You wrote for the NYRB for many years and served as its editor-in-chief for just 12 months before you were forced to resign in 2018. Now, this was the result of your decision to publish an article written by former Canadian broadcaster Gian Gomeshi, who was accused of a sexual assault by more than 20 women. Gomeshi faced charges, including for sexual assault, but was acquitted in 2016. Now, as a journalist myself, who has far fewer years under my belt, I'd just like to understand your thought process and why you felt that it was an important piece to publish.
Well, the main reason is that an important issue should be looked at from different angles so that people can make up their own minds about it. And it was never our intention or my intention to minimize the suffering of women at the hands of violent or abusive men. It was more to take a look at a particular problem that is occurring more and more in the internet age, where people who are accused of a crime and are then either acquitted by a court or, as in the case of Woody Allen, for example, not even charged, and then they are, in a way, punished by public opinion, particularly on the social media. And I was interested in making people think about what that problem really involves. And, you know, we have law courts, we have laws in order to take care of people who commit crimes. But what if the law does not take care of it? If something is not, if somebody is not held guilty or not guilty in a court of law, to what then happens, and how should we, what should we think of, punishment by public opinion? And I thought a personal account of somebody who'd been through this particular experience would be interesting without having any particular views on whether this was a nice person or not a nice person. It was a way to think about it in a different light.
Now, in another interview, you described your resignation as a capitulation to social media and university presses who were threatening to withdraw ad spend as a result of the public backlash. But then you also went on to say that you didn't gauge correctly the forces that the Me Too movement had awakened and that you now perhaps question your own judgment. So in hindsight, would you have continued to publish that article? What perhaps might you have done differently?
I probably would have published the article, but perhaps qualified it by making absolutely sure that the readers realized. I thought that this would be taken for granted, but that the readers would realize that we didn't publish this article because we condoned anything that this particular person had or had may not have had done or possibly did not do. The reason for publishing it was to look at his of the experience of a person who is punished by public opinion through the social media, and we might have put it in that context so that there could be no misunderstanding about it. I'm still of a generation where journalism and editing a journal means that you can have all kinds of opinions, you can take risks, you can even risk offending people, and then you open the discussion. And if people disagree or are offended or want to voice a different opinion, then that should lead to a fruitful debate. I think the problem with the way that the social media operates is that debate very often goes out the window, and instead of that, people denounce and try and, you know, get people to resign or get fired or something else like that. But it's not a fruitful debate, which, in my view, fruitful debate, that is, should be the core of a lively intellectual culture.
Well, thank you very much for clarifying that for us, Ian, and for making your stance a little bit clearer. But I also do want to get into a little bit your vast body of work, because you've been writing for 30 years and you've authored multiple books and have been a long-time observer, particularly of Asian politics. And U.S.-China trade relations were the focus of much of 2019, but now that relationship between the two countries is in the spotlight once again. So what is your take on it? Do you think we'll see the rapport between the two countries deteriorate in the face of COVID-19?
Well, it's not only about COVID-19. It's a phenomenon that we've seen before in history, without assuming that what happened in the past is necessarily going to happen in exactly the same way in our own time. But China is a rising power. It feels that it's being, or the government feels that it's being held back by the West, that has been more powerful than China and other parts of Asia for centuries now. And the United States, partly because of President Trump and his policies, is losing authority and prestige and because of that, a lot of clout. And so this is leading to frictions. So this is a natural phenomenon. It happens over and over in history. Now, how this will play out, who knows? We're not only looking at rational forces and rational interests, whether they're national or personal. We're also looking at leaders who are not necessarily rational and who try and appeal to feelings that are not necessarily rational either.
But in your view and as an observer, how much of this almost acrimonious relationship at this point in time is driven by those same leaders? So perhaps how much does it have to do with election fever on Donald Trump's side? And at the end of the day, does it matter to Xi Jinping, considering he doesn't have the same kind of time limit hanging over his head?
Well, I think in the case of China, you have a domestic problem, and many of these frictions between countries really go back to domestic politics, which drive the relations with other countries. I think in the case of China, what has happened is that you have a communist party, which calls itself communist, which claims the monopoly on power. It's a dictatorship. And this used to be justified by Marxist, Leninist, Maoist ideology. Now, that's clearly not enough anymore. China is not a classically communist country. The Communist Party is not really a communist party anymore. Very few Chinese really believe in communist dogma. So they need another reason to justify their monopoly on power. And the reason becomes nationalism. And modern China, contemporary Chinese nationalism is based on the idea that China has been the victim of larger powers, European, American, and Japanese in particular, and has suffered and been humiliated for several hundred years. And it's now time for China to reassert itself as a great power, even perhaps as the Middle Kingdom again, even as a country that can show the world a model that needs to be emulated. And that kind of nationalism obviously rubs up against the nationalisms of other countries. Now, your question was, to what extent do the different leaders and their personalities matter? Well, they matter, certainly in the case of the United States, where Trump, who has very little understanding of international relations or of Chinese nationalism or any of that sort, he has no interest in it. He has no historical sense. But he does very much care about himself. So you have a narcissist leading one of the most formidable powers in the world against a country whose leadership claims and continues to claim the monopoly on power and wants to even consolidate that by becoming more authoritarian, by drawing on historic hurts and a resentful form of nationalism.
I'm speaking with Ian Buruma, author and former editor of the New York Review of Books. After this, a deeper dive into whether or not China truly is something to fear. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Ian Buruma, author and former editor of the New York Review of Books. Now, Ian, I just wanted to ask you, how much of this narrative of an assertive China is actually something to fear? I mean, how much of it stems perhaps from an Orientalist viewpoint, fear of an other?
If we think in terms of the other and Orientalism and Western, perhaps even racist attitudes towards the non-West and so on, this clearly does exist. You cannot completely dismiss these things. But I think there are rational reasons to be worried about the way China is developing at the moment. And they have very little to do with some kind of essential Chinese culture or the East against the West or a clash of civilizations, let alone race. They have to do with the particular nature of the Chinese authoritarian system and the nationalism that it's exploiting, which is a very modern form of nationalism. It's not something that goes back deep into Chinese imperial history or anything of that kind. And as a demonstration of why the way China is governed today is not some essential Oriental or Chinese tradition, one only needs to look at the rebellion in Hong Kong and the democracy in Taiwan and in South Korea and in Japan and parts of Southeast Asia, which don't conform to the Chinese idea of traditional culture or civilization at all. I think this was the problem with the Asian values debate that took place some decades ago, which came from Singapore and to some extent from Malaysia too, which really posited the idea that authoritarianism and obedience to authority and so on was an essential Asian value as opposed to Western democracy. Well, one of the most trenchant critics of that notion was Kim Dae-jung, a Korean, South Korean politician, who said, you know, that Asians should be entitled to democracy just as much as non-Asians.
So with China's population becoming increasingly middle class, is it possible that those democratic ideals may take root, or is authoritarianism too deeply entrenched?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily deeply entrenched. In 1989, it could have gone in a different direction. I mean, it wouldn't have been completely impossible for the government to come to some kind of compromise and for elections to be held and a gradual transition to democracy, as it took place in South Korea and Taiwan. It was not impossible. So I don't think it's deeply entrenched in the sense that it's been there for 1,000 years or longer and therefore can't be changed. It can change. But the notion that because you develop a middle class with people who are economically better off and have more comfortable lives and have air conditioning in their apartments and so on, and that means that they naturally become liberal democrats, I think that was probably an illusion that was held for a long time in the West and in parts of Asia too. This is clearly not the case, and I think Singapore has been a very interesting model. And I think that Deng Xiaoping, the former strongman in China, what he really wanted was not really what Xi Jinping is doing now. He wanted China to be more like Singapore and make a deal with the rising middle class. So people could be prosperous, they could go on holidays, they could buy any car they wanted, they could marry who they wanted, and so on, as long as they did not get involved in politics and in protest movements and in opposition and that kind of thing. That was the deal that was offered. And it's a deal that is held for a long time in Singapore, and it could hold for quite a while in China, as long as the middle class does well. Mm. Because I think the Chinese have been so traumatized by at least 100 years of war and bloodshed and purges and autocracy and so on, that they rather fear democracy. They want the order that allows them to live peacefully and comfortably. And I think many people are convinced that democracy would create chaos and disorder and bring back the kind of violence that people fear.
So, you know, you raised the subject of the rebellion and the protests that are happening in Hong Kong. And the 31st anniversary of Tiananmen Square has just passed. So compared to 1989, China has taken great strides forward onto the international stage. But how much has China changed in its attitude towards those who would oppose or question a wider central authority? Because one of the books you wrote was called Bad Elements, and it looked at exactly this, the people who were considered dissidents in the wake of 1989.
Well, the reason I wrote that book is that the way that in the Chinese-speaking world, not just in communist China, mm-hmm. The way the propaganda was shaped was that dissidents, opposition, and so on was inherently anti-Chinese or not part of Asian values. In other words, that obedience to the authorities, whoever they are, whether it's the PAP in Singapore or the Communist Party in China, that they're the natural rulers and it's an Asian value for people to obey them. And if they don't, well, then they're deluded, they're westernized, they're no longer properly Chinese. And I tried to challenge that by showing how dissidents in many parts of all parts of the Chinese world, were just as Chinese as anybody else, but they just had different political opinions. And how have things changed? Well, I think in the 80s, after, when Deng Xiaoping was in power, after the Cultural Revolution and so on, there was a degree of openness. Students were debating, people were writing things. There was an openness to new ideas that in some ways, I think, under Xi Jinping has disappeared. I mean, it began to disappear after 1989, but even the 90s were more open, I think, intellectually and politically than they are now. So I think under Xi, things have taken a turn for the worse.
Do you see this continuing as we enter into COVID-19 recovery stages? Because, I mean, one of the elements of any crisis situation is that it does generally allow governments to crack down further on criticism with the excuse of a national emergency at hand.
Well, that could very well happen. Something else that could happen as a consequence of the friction between the United States and China, which, as I said, is not necessarily entirely rational and has to do with personalities as much as anything else, could also make things worse. For example, it's not all that difficult to whip up a lot of nationalist fervor and resentments in China, especially amongst young people. And the more belligerent the language coming from the United States, the easier it is for a lot of Chinese to feel that they're being unfairly treated, that they're being humiliated again, that they're not taken seriously, that they're not being allowed to have their time in the sun, and so on. And this could be easily exploited by the Chinese government. But, of course, the Chinese government, whichever Chinese government is in power, they always have to be a little careful with nationalism and whipping it up. They can whip it up to their advantage to some extent. It could also turn against the government very easily. And we've seen this also in the past. You know, the May 4th movement in 1919 is a good example of where young people, students and others, start blaming the government for not being nationalistic enough, being soft on the external enemies and so on. So I'm not going to predict anything because I think that's foolish, but further friction with the United States probably in the short run would play into Xi Jinping's hands.
How prevalent actually is that sense of national humiliation in a modern China? Because others have written about the politics of national memory as it applies to Chinese history. Is that sense of national humiliation still present in the current iteration of China?
These things ebb and flow, and it can, it, these are emotions that in the daily lives of most people don't really play much of a role. Mm-hmm. I mean, most Chinese are too busy taking care of their families and getting by and so on to worry deeply about the Opium War. But there are, these are things that can be easily whipped up, and they can be whipped up especially easily amongst the most educated people. I think that most farmers and workers and so on who have their hands full just surviving in a tough economy don't care particularly about the history of international relations.
Because political ideology is can be a privilege in itself because it means you don't really have to worry about putting a roof over your head.
I think that is probably true, and that's true not just in China, but that's true everywhere.
So I guess for my final question, Ian, is a little bit of a shift in tack. I actually do want to know what lies ahead for the publishing industry, because you've published multiple books and you've been deeply involved in this industry. And in an age where attention spans are short and where there are 1,000 things on our mobile phones competing for our attention, I mean, the idea of sitting down to read a book can almost seem impossible.
Well, I think reading books always was a niche industry and will probably continue to be so and perhaps become a little more marginal. On the other hand, bestsellers now are bigger bestsellers than they've ever been before in history. So I don't think books are going to disappear. They clearly don't have authors, novelists and so on, don't have the central position in culture that they once had. They have to compete with many other things. That's all true, but I think it will continue. People will continue. More people are probably writing now than reading in one way or another. So people continue to write, people continue to read. How this will happen, it doesn't bother me very much that people would stop reading books in their hands and would read on Kindles and other electronic means, as long as they read. And I think they will continue to do that because a book, there are certain things that only a book can do. I mean, there's only so much you can say in a tweet. And if you want to build something larger, have an argument that is more involved, that goes deeper and so on, you need to write at length. And that means, in the end, a book. And yes, the majority of any population will not be reading these books, but they never did. People forget that.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning, Ian. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
It was a great pleasure doing so.
I've been speaking with Ian Buruma, author and former editor of the New York Review of Books. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.